Games and Libraries podcast for October 2009. Hi there, this is Scott Nicholson. I'm an associate professor at Syracuse University School of Information Studies, and I'm your host for the Games and Libraries podcast. This month's episode is all about National Gaming Day at your library. What we've done is assembled a set of segments that will give you some ideas of things you might want to consider doing for National Gaming Day. Now, what we're trying to do on this day is get as many people to go to libraries as possible to play games. And then afterwards, we're going to ask you some questions about how many people came. So please keep a count of how many people came to your library. Also, take notes of what were the games that were played. We also are always curious about what were the goals and the outcomes. And then also, you'll be able to tell us about this right after National Gaming Day. But next year, and in January or February, I'll be putting out another big census, and you can talk about this program as part of that census. So last year, we had 15,000 people come to libraries and play games on National Gaming Day, and we want to top that number this year. That's our goal. So please host games, but more importantly, count people, write down activities, and provide us back with that data. The website where all of this is coordinated is over at ngd.ala.org. That's a blog, and you can find out what's going on and stay in touch with everyone there. There's a form where you can register your library as a participant, and you can find that URL on the show notes at gamesandlibraries.org for this blog entry. Registering will help us to stay in touch with you about what's going on and contact you about other opportunities as they come up down the future. It also puts your library on a map of all the libraries doing gaming and help us to reach out to you to get answers for this survey so we can find out how many people played games in libraries. Some of the big things that'll be going on, there's going to be a couple video game tournaments, which you'll hear about later on in this episode, hosted by Eli Neuberger through GT System, which is his system through Ann Arbor District Library. Hasbro is sending copies of three games to all the public libraries in the U.S. Last year, they sent one game. This year, they're going to be sending three card games out. North Star Games has already donated 1,000 copies of their games, Wits and Wagers, and Say Anything. And Alpha Bound has donated 1,000 copies of Letter Jam. These have gone out to libraries that have already registered. All of the copies they donated are gone. But if you go ahead and register, next year we can let you know about these opportunities early so you can get free games too. But everyone's getting the games from Hasbro. Hasbro is the exclusive sponsor for National Gaming Day, and we're really appreciative of their support. So it's going to be an exciting time. Tryouts and gaming programs. On this episode, you're going to be hearing from a number of folks. Brian Mayer is going to talk about what school libraries might want to consider doing since National Gaming Day is held on a Saturday. Kelly Zarnecki is going to be talking about a report that came out called Game Changer, Investing in Digital Play to Advance Children's Learning and Health, and give you some ideas on the advocacy part of gaming. Julie Scordato is going to talk about the Columbus Metropolitan Library, their projects, and how they're continuing to advocate gaming. We're going to have a new contributor join us this month, J.J. Lanza, and J.J. is going to be starting a series called RPG 101, where he talks about tabletop role-playing games and what those are. I'll be back on, and I'm going to talk about free games that you could consider doing for National Gaming Day. If you've got no budget at all, but you want to do some gaming, I'll give you some good ideas. Eli Neuberger will then come and talk about the three video game tournaments that will be going on. Two of them are on the National Gaming Day on November 14th, and then he's running another one, a Mario Kart tournament, on Sunday, November 15th, the day after National Gaming Day. So this will give you some different ideas of things you might want to do on National Gaming Day at your library. Again, for more information, head to ngd.ala.org. But now, on with the show.
Hello, everybody. This is Brian Mayer, library gamer, and I'd like to talk to you today about National Gaming Day at your library and how school libraries can be involved. Now, we need to talk about this because National Gaming Day at your library is taking place on a Saturday, and that falls outside the days in which schools normally meet. So, what do we do? There's a few different ways that school libraries can actually participate and be involved, some of them in a support role and also in a leading role. Supporting is very important. School libraries, what you can do, actually, is support programs and events already scheduled taking place in the public and the academic libraries in your community. You can talk to your librarians to find out what they're planning on doing and how you can help them out. Some ways that you can help them out is doing promotions. School librarians, you are one of the most vital ways that public libraries can reach teens, middle school students, and even younger students to get them excited and interested in going to the public library. because you have access to these students so that you can talk to them, share your enthusiasm and your excitement. And you can also get them excited and prepared for the academic libraries as well, too. What a great way to introduce students to the academic library is by introducing them to some event taking place surrounding National Gaming Day at your library. So, school librarians, you can put up posters. You can get on the morning announcements and talk about what's going to be happening. You can also volunteer your time at one of these events on Saturday. Having your face and your presence be there really reinforces the connection between all these different library types. So that's some of the ways in which school libraries can play a supportive role in National Gaming Day in your library. Now, some school libraries may be able to play not just a supportive role, but a leading role as well, too. Now, this really will depend on the policies and the environment of your school. If you're able to have the students stay outside of the scope of the regular hours, then you may be able to do something with National Gaming Day in your library. One possibility is to do what they call a lock-in. And so Friday night, some teachers, some parent volunteers, and students can all sign up to be locked into the school and participate in a whole bunch of different activities, part of which can be a lot of gaming activities. And the students can play and game and socialize and interact all evening into the wee hours of the morning and into National Gaming Day. Another possibility is to actually have an event in your school on Saturday. Now this, of course, both of these will actually require talking to your administrators, talking to teachers to get volunteers, talking to parents to get people to come and help, having permission forms and making sure everything's in place. But if you have a school environment that's supportive of having events on the weekend, then you can still have something at your library to participate in National Gaming Day at your library. If you are interested in playing a supportive role, then I highly recommend talking to the libraries in your community to find out how you can help. And if you're interested in taking a leading role, then please go to the National Gaming Day at your library website to take advantage of all the resources that are available there to help you get a program started. Remember, gaming is a fantastic way to reach out to students. By including it in the programs and as a resource, it's helping them identify with you because you're using a format and a genre with which they well identify with and enjoy. This is Brian Mayer, Library Gamer, saying, keep on gaming and keep on learning.
Hi, I'm Kelly Zarnicki, a technology education librarian in Charlotte, North Carolina. In June 2009, the Joan Ganz Cooney Center in New York issued a policy brief titled Game Changer, Investing in Digital Play to Advance Children's Learning and Health. The URL for where the full report can be found will be listed in the show notes at the end of this podcast. I'll briefly summarize the major findings of the report here, and then go on and connect some ideas from the report to what you might want to do at your library for National Gaming Day, which will be in November of 2009. This report tries to answer the question, can digital games, especially well-designed educational games, help reshape our nation's approach to learning and growing? The report notes that 3/4 of American children play computer and video games. The report determined that digital games show potential to promote children's growth and healthy development. Some examples they pointed out were Dance Dance Revolution, a physical game that many states have in fact adopted to use as part of their physical education classes. Another game the report points out is called Remission, which is a computer-based game that helps young cancer patients be more familiar with their disease. While the report lists several other examples where digital games show potential to promote children's growth and healthy development, it does acknowledge several factors. We need to know more about designing games that increase learning, how games can be best integrated into the classroom and other learning environments. We need to be able to identify the learning gained through games. We should establish a national best practices initiative to disseminate effective uses of games technologies. Be trained to use and understand the benefits and limitations of digital games. Outreach to parents to make research understandable. Professional development for teachers on integrating gaming into the curriculum. Expand current experimentation with new formats. In addition to playing some of the great games mentioned in the other podcasts for National Gaming Day, in light of this report, you might consider adding an advocacy component to the day as well. Offering a few hours to work with parents or teachers can be a great way to kick off or end the day. Inviting a local game store to try something new at your branch that you haven't done before is probably a sure way to get the patrons, not to mention you and the staff, fired up about what's going on with gaming. Tapping into the public health clinic, local hospitals, or gym classes that might be integrating video games as a health service can be a way to reach out into the community and help make connections about what is available. Good luck, and be sure to share what you did on ALA Connect at the Games and Gaming Group.
Hi, my name is Julie Scordato, and I am the Youth Services Leader, Specialization Teen Services, for the Columbus Metropolitan Library in Columbus, Ohio. And today I want to talk about the continued advocacy for gaming once the shine wears off. But before I get to that main point, let me give you some background on what CML, Columbus Metropolitan Library, has done with gaming. In March 2007, we unrolled gaming system-wide across our 21 locations to celebrate the first National Teen Tech Week. To unroll gaming, we kicked off first National Teen Tech Week by having every single location hold at least one open gaming. And what we offered was Guitar Hero and Dance Dance Revolution on PlayStation. We were able to offer all of this equipment and programming through our 21 locations because our administration and our board of trustees really embraced the idea of meeting teenagers where they are and using technology that's a part of their daily life and pursuing programming that allows opportunities to build casual relationships where the library staff are facilitators rather than presenters, and able to talk with the teens on a one-on-one basis and take some of the pressure off that adult-teen relationship that they're so used to in other structured youth programs. We had nearly 400 teens participate in 1 week for Teen Tech Week 2007. We continued to do open gaming throughout 2007, and in July, our second installment of gaming equipment provided all 21 locations with a Nintendo Wii and three extra controllers so four players could participate in a game. And we also supplied each location with a copy of Wii Sports to go along with the Wii. And we also gave each branch, I think it was $260 to spend on their own for other games or an extra console if they wish. So it was a very large upfront investment. Columbus Metropolitan Library essentially invested over $20,000 in gaming equipment for the year 2007. Now, what we got out of that investment was nearly 15,000 teens participating in gaming to date in less than 3 years. For our gaming programs, we have gained an enormous amount of cross-participation. Teens who have come to gaming programs and then have become volunteers or have joined or started book groups or went on to participate in other library activities. We have seen teens who have had discipline problems and behavioral problems in the past with library staff improve their behavior, improve their respect with library staff, and overall improve their perception of the library. We have spent less money in subsequent years after that upfront investment. We give each branch a certain amount of money each year, which has fluctuated with the budget, and we let the branches really determine what their customers want. What, you know, one branch, Guitar Hero is the big thing, so they spend more of their budget money on Rock Band and updated Guitar Hero games. Another branch, you know, chose to buy a second Xbox, so because Xbox was so popular at their branch. So we do leave the yearly spending up to the discretion of the branches. And even as funding shrinks, we still make room for branches to have $200, $250 to purchase replacement equipment and new games. So that's the basic overview of what Columbus Metropolitan Library is doing in terms of gaming equipment. We are part of the GT system, tournament system out of Ann Arbor, and are currently in the process of developing best practices and trainings for using the tournament software for so many locations. And this is something that we will be sharing as we go and as we make further progress, considering all the variables of, you know, 21 locations doing tournament play. So what I want to talk about now is this idea that gaming is reaching what I think is a critical point in our libraries and in the field. It seems to me that we're getting past that gee whiz, hey, wow, isn't this cool stage, and we're getting into the stage where we can either have gaming really be accepted or people can develop not a negative attitude but an indifferent attitude. And sometimes indifference is harder to work with. I think that as resources continue to shrink in this economy and libraries face tougher and tighter budgets, gaming, which seemed to make sense and have really great results and, you know, provide experiences that even the most negative library staff would still need convincing, you know, at this point, we need to advocate for gaming now that the shine has worn off a little bit and remind our colleagues and our administrators and our board that the results of gaming do not change, that even if there's less money to spend on programming, even if there's less money to spend on gaming, the investment is worth it. You can get miles and miles and miles out of a console. You can have teens bring games from home. You can work with your local game stores and local gaming clubs to partner up to share resources. But no matter what the dollar amount is, the bottom line with gaming is that it provides a universal experience that allows teens of all socioeconomic and cultural backgrounds to enjoy and play together and participate together. It allows teen services staff a chance to provide a program with extremely low preparation time and extremely high results. And also a program where teenagers can participate and volunteer to facilitate and help the library staff with the program. It's a program that allows non-teen services staff to facilitate and have successful interactions with the teen customers in their library. It's a vehicle to bring new teenagers into your branches and encourage repeat visits and improve the behavior and general relations with staff. None of these outcomes change when budgets shrink. And so I think as a gaming advocate, one always needs to be on the alert for when we start to look at budgets and so-and-so says, oh, gaming, it's so expensive. You know, remind them, you know, divide the amount of money that you have spent on gaming by the number of participants, by the number of repeat visitors, if you've been keeping track of that. If you haven't, I highly recommend that you try. And track those anecdotes. Track that teenager that a library staff person helped find a book for them based on a conversation they were able to have in a casual context of gaming. Point out those two teenagers who have had so many evictions coming in every week helping with gaming. When the shine wears off of new projects and new initiatives, it's often our role to not fall into indifference ourselves and take anything for granted. And we need to always be telling the teen services story and the gaming story and reminding people that, you know, that PlayStation that you bought used at your local gaming store has, you know, averaged out $1.50 a teen, $2 a teen in usage. Remind people what the real numbers are and what the real figures are, and work with the Lib Gaming folks and the ALA toolkit to find out ways that you can continue to offer gaming in times of less budget. Show that not only that you are resourceful, but that gaming does not have to be a high-ticket item. And most of all, no matter how much your library spends on gaming, the results stay the same. The results are extremely positive and varied. Thank you.
Hi, my name is JJ Lanza, and while I'm not a librarian, I've played one in a role-playing game. I've been an RPG player for almost 30 years, the last three of which I've spent either podcasting or blogging about it. I guess you could say I'm an RPG advocate. Role-playing games have been my passion ever since I lifted the magenta cover off the basic box set of Dungeons & Dragons. Inside the box was nothing like any game I've ever played before. It had lots of funny-shaped dice, a rule book, and an adventure module. No board, no tokens, no paper money. Now, up until this point, you may have thought I was talking about some computer or console game, or maybe you thought I was talking about a board game. And that's okay. Some RPGs have a lot in common with both those types of games, which can make things confusing. Most folks don't know what I'm talking about at first, but that's what I'm here for, to help you understand more about the enigmatic tabletop role-playing game. So let's start by defining what a tabletop role-playing game is. From there, we'll see what things they have in common with other games and how they differ. Finally, we'll talk about some of the common elements you'll find in most RPGs. Basically, a role-playing game is one in which the players participate and experience a fictional world through the use of an adopted persona. Some folks like to say it's make-believe. I don't like to simplify it that much. Make-believe is typically a form of play and often lacks structure or a goal. Tabletop role-playing games generally have some structure and a goal. I've used the word tabletop several times now in reference to RPGs, and this is to make it distinct from video or live-action RPGs because play usually, but not always, happens around a table. They're often called pen and paper RPGs because players use these items to record information, such as items possessed by the persona or simply to record the proceeding of play. Role-playing games are a narrative experience. Players interact with a fictional environment and create an ongoing story through play. Depending on the particular rule set used, often known as a system, players have a lesser or greater degree of control over the environment and what story elements may be introduced. And finally, RPGs are generally a cooperative endeavor. Players work together to overcome obstacles and advance the story toward a desired goal or outcome. Given this description, you may be thinking of several games you already play that fit the bill. There are computer games and console games that are billed as RPGs. You have a persona in a game environment through which you experience play. They have names and abilities just like the personas in a tabletop RPG. Several board games, such as Fantasy Flight Games' Arkham Horror, give players a persona to play in-game with varying degree of abilities. And board games are played around a table just like the tabletop RPGs I'm talking about. Some traditional RPGs have a board game feel as a result of their use of miniature figurines or tokens used to represent persona and elements from the game that are displayed on a grid or board to represent the environment they inhabit. This is a telltale sign of tabletop RPGs' origins in tabletop wargaming. John Kim says it best when describing the difference between tabletop RPGs and the rest. If you were a spectator watching one of these games, you might lean forward to suggest a move to a player. If the player turns around and tells you his character wouldn't do that, then it's a role-playing game. I'll have a link to John's website at the end of this segment. Identification with the persona of the game is important. The goals of a persona may be very different from that of the player. That's the role-playing part of it. It's still a game. There's still a goal, and there are specific mechanics in the game to determine whether or not players and their personas can achieve it. Tabletop RPGs are dynamic. You can literally do anything you can imagine within the structure of the shared game world. In a video game, you might want to pick up a chair and hit the bad guy over the head with it, or break a bottle on his chin, but if it isn't programmed in, the best you can manage is to poke at him with your virtual fist. Unlike a video or board game, players are rarely limited to where they can go within the game world. And if they are, it's called railroading, but that's a lesson for another segment. Players can direct their personas where they will within the game. The quickest path to treasure may not always be the most obvious, and players are often rewarded for taking the road less traveled. Spontaneity and creativity are the buzzwords when talking about tabletop role-playing games. Players often think outside the box when they work together to overcome obstacles in the game. Now, let's take a look at some of the things common to most tabletop RPGs. From this point forward, I'm going to drop the tabletop since it's understood which type of RPG I'm talking about. And besides, Scott asked me to keep it under 10 minutes, and I'll never make it if I have to keep saying tabletop over and over. Anyway, the first common element has been mentioned many times already, the persona. In RPG parlance, this is typically referred to as player character or PC. A player character will generally be under the direct control of one player, and each player will generally have only one PC per game session. The same PC is played from session to session. These player characters are the protagonists in our narrative. A player character can be described in a number of ways, each dependent on the particular game system you're playing. Most RPGs use a numeric system to describe the PC's capabilities in the fictional game world. Some RPGs, however, use words and adjectives instead of numbers. Characters which are not a protagonist and not directly controlled by a player are typically called non-player characters, or NPCs. These characters act as foils to the PCs and generally serve as obstacles to the players or points of interest to interact with in the game world. These NPCs are often controlled by one player with a little bit more responsibility than the rest. This leads us to our next common element, the Game Master. A Game Master is also known as a GM. Have you guessed that RPG players like acronyms? A GM is part referee, part storyteller, part antagonist. The GM is the main authority in the game when determining how the game world reacts to the player's actions. The GM is the guide whose primary responsibility is to facilitate the growing narrative. Most RPGs have GMs. A growing number do not. GM-less games are very exciting and dynamic, and we'll be sure to cover some in a future segment. RPGs typically level the playing field by introducing an element of randomness when determining the outcome of PC actions within the game. These randomizers may take many forms. You heard me mention many-sided dice, with as little as 4 sides and up to 20 being common. Some games use playing cards and others use bidding mechanics. Specific randomizer is dependent upon the game system played and adds to the flavor of play. Another common element that's already been mentioned a lot is the game world or setting. These settings come in every form imaginable: magical, fantasy, historical periods, far-flung worlds in another galaxy, or even your own modern-day hometown. The last element I'll mention in this segment is a reward. Rewards take many forms. Sometimes they're called experience points or XPs. Other games reward fate points, which can be used to affect the outcome of an action. Rewards are typically used to allow the player character to grow and change between sessions of play over the course of the collaborative story. And that brings this first segment of RPG 101 to a close, but before I go, I'll leave you with some resources if you're interested in exploring more in the exciting world of RPGs before our next session. To learn more about what a role-playing game is, check out John Kim's website, which you can reach by using tinyurl.com/whatisRPG. And that's all one word, what is RPG? Bill Walton has an excellent resource website at theescapist.com. That's theescapist.com. I'll be coming back to his site throughout the segments. And this time around, I want to point you to his RPGs in Library project called Terra Libris. You can reach it at tinyurl.com/library RPG. Bill also defines many of the terms I used in this segment, and you can reach this page on RPG jargon by using, you guessed it, tinyurl.com/RPG jargon. And finally, you can find my latest blog at back2rpgbasics.blogspot.com. And that's the word back, the number 2, rpgbasics.blogspot.com. If you have any topics you'd like me to cover in future segments, you can find me on ALA Connect, or you can contact me through my blog. All of these links will be in the show notes. So that wraps it up for now. Thanks for listening.
Hi there, this is Scott Nicholson from Syracuse University. I'm going to be talking about how to do some library gaming experiences that don't cost a lot of money. So while I'd be tempted to call these free, in reality they're not. They do use library space and staff resources. You need to remember that sort of stuff when you're setting it up. But we can at least reduce the amount of cost that you're going to spend on the games themselves. Now, the first type of game program that works well for this is a bring-a-game program. In these programs, what you do is you invite everyone to bring games that they like and share them with others. If the library already has a projector and a setup in a room, well, people, you can help them hook up their systems to the projector, and they can take a game that they like to play at home, but now play it in the size of a wall. And it's a great way to share a game with other people. Board games and card games are great things to share. A cool intergenerational program along these lines is a bring a game from your childhood program, where you invite folks to come in and bring one of the games they played as kids, pick up sticks, jacks, card games, and teach other people. That can be a really nice intergenerational thing. Another type of gaming program to consider are collectible card game events. Now, collectible card games are games like Pokemon or Magic the Gathering or HeroClix is a collectible miniatures event. And the thing behind these games is it's about people building up collections. And so when you host one of these events, you're really not hosting a gaming event where people can play your games, you're hosting a time where people can get together and trade and play with each other. Because when you do these, they're like baseball cards, and so you need a social opportunity to meet other players and make exchanges, and the library could provide that venue. So this wouldn't cost the library anything to have a collectible card game trading day, where you invite people to come in and trade with each other their collectible card games. Now, if the library wants to help people to play, you can get starter kits for many of these games for not much money at all. Another thing to think about are games where the rules are in the public domain. So that's going to be things like chess and backgammon and checkers. Those are very inexpensive games. Using a deck of cards, you can play a lot of games. You know, serious games like bridge or lighter games like rummy or kids games like slapjack. There's a lot you can do with a deck of cards. And even having a day where you set up tables and each table a certain game is played, people could come in and learn a certain game, especially if there's a game that's really popular in your region, like Pinnacle or Sheep's Head or something like that. You could teach it at this type of event. There's a couple unusual games. I talked about 1,000 Blank White Cards last month. Another game I'll talk about in the future is Werewolf. Both of these are games that have public domain rule sets that aren't going to cost you much to bring into your library. Now, another angle are role-playing games, just like you've heard about. You can actually do a role-playing game without going out and buying dice and rule sets and all of that. What you can do is you can have a book talk where everyone's read a book. Let's say you take one of the Harry Potter books, and you have a book talk about it, and so everyone chats about the book. And then what you do is you split the whole room up into small groups, and within each group, you assign each person one of the characters from the book. You know, you're going to be Dumbledore, you're going to be Harry, etc. And then you give each group a challenge, a new challenge that they have to figure out how the characters in the book would interact to deal with that challenge. So it's a storytelling role-playing game where each player is just talking about, well, Dumbledore would do this. The players could even get into character if they wanted, acting out with voices, or they could talk about it from a third-person view and talk through what would be the challenges, what would happen. And this is a way to do a role-playing game experiences that allow people to explore what went on in a book without having to spend a lot of money and time preparing a standard tabletop role-playing game. There's a lot of other things to consider. Icebreaker games, large group icebreaker games, can work well for very inexpensive events. Puzzle hunts, where you create a series of puzzles that are hidden in different areas of the library, and each puzzle leads you to the next puzzle. Or a game creation event, where you bring together a group of people, you give each group the same box of junk, and you tell them you have an hour to make a game. And then everyone plays everyone else's game. And that can be a fun way to use stuff that you've got around the library to get people to engage with each other without spending a lot of money. So it would be very easy to put on one of these gaming events without having to pay money for the games. Again, you still need time and you still need volunteers or staff members to keep it going, but having gaming in your library does not have to cost a lot of money. So if you have other interesting ideas, why don't you head over to the ALA Connect group for the Games and Gaming Members Initiative group, and you can chat about other free ideas that you have for gaming in your library. Thanks a lot.
Hi, how's it going? It's Eli, and we're going to talk about National Gaming Day 2009. It's coming up. It's Son of National Gaming Day 2008. So now we're back for another year of National Gaming Day, and those of you who participated last year, it's a really, really fun way to extend the value of your video game tournaments or to get started doing video game tournaments, because there's a lot of structure out there, and for kids to be part of something big that's going on all around the country really adds a lot of value, and it really kind of reinforces the library's role as gateway to the world and universe and beyond and such. So we got three different things going on the video game side this year for National Gaming Day. One is a Rock Band High Score Contest. Now, this is for any version of Rock Band, any song, any level of difficulty. Basically, that makes the tournament a lot easier to manage. It also means that choosing the right song becomes part of the game. So all you need to do to be in the National Rock Band High Score Tournament, it's taking place on the weekend, Saturday, November 14th. So you need a GT system site to be able to participate, because that's where you log your scores. And basically what will happen is that we will find the highest score submitted on National Gaming Day across all the libraries that are participating and entering scores, and we will publish the top 10 bands posted the highest scores on National Gaming Day through GT System. So to get signed up with GT System, you can go to wiki.gtsystem.org. We can get you signed up with an account. Generally, if you're part of a library system, we want to sign up your library system for GT System. And then what we do is we create branches for your underneath your library system so that you can have your own site. It's very simple to get set up. Just contact us at gtsystem@aadl.org. As it says on the page, there's a lot of more information at wiki.gtsystem.org. And GT System is always free. Once you get signed up, all you need to do is create an event. And there's a page on the wiki that tells you how to create an event. And then you register the bands, and you can register 3-player bands or 4-player bands. It really doesn't matter. All you're doing is putting in the name of the band and the song they play and the score that they post. And then we'll look for the highest score. Now, don't let your kids enter the scores, because they are going to inflate the scores. You want to enter the real scores yourselves and try to get as accurate of a score in there as possible. And if you put in the songs, then we'll be able to see what songs the top scoring bands used. So it's going to be a pretty cool thing. It was a lot of fun last year. Our top scoring band was called Chinese Democracy. Wonder where that came from. And hopefully this year we'll have a lot more interest. Again, don't require a particular difficulty, don't require a particular song or version or anything. Anything goes. It is not only a contest of how good you are at Rock Band, but a contest of how good you are at choosing a song on which you can generate a high score. So that's the Rock Band tournament. It's a very easy thing to do, because all you need to do is sign up your bands and call them one at a time, and each let them have a turn. And as much time as you have, you can have turns for all your different band members. The next event is a little bit more complex, and that's our National Gaming Day Super Smash Brothers Brawl Bracket. This was a lot of fun last year, marred by a couple of technical problems, but we have some excellent solutions to them in place this year. And those of us who did participate last year found that this was a really, really exciting thing for our kids. And basically, the way that it works is that each library that signs up for it will provide a 4-player Smash Brothers Brawl team. So you need to select who your 4 players are going to be. And there's lots of different ways you can do it. You can start your event early and have like a little mini tournament to select your players. You could have selected them based on previous events. You could even just have the room decide who their four champions will be. But each library that participates needs to field a four-player team. Then what'll happen is we'll make pools of four libraries each, and that will be roughly geographically limited when we start off with. Last year, we had 32 libraries to start off with. This year, we may be able to fill a 64-library bracket. We'll see how it goes. Once you get matched up, you'll be matched up with four other libraries, and you'll play a series of four three-stock, five-minute matches with items set to low. Now, this sometimes having items on will make some of the hardcore players say, oh, this isn't a real tournament. But the best way to explain this to them is say, look, you don't know who we're going up against. We could be vastly outgunned and we could really, really need those items to have a chance at moving on to the next round. So basically what happens is we take four players from each library and four libraries per pool. The number four players play together. So your number four plays against the other three libraries' number four players. Then all the number three players play. Then all the number two players play. Then all the number one players play. So you play four matches in quick succession. You get 10 points for first place, 8 points for second place, 6 points for third place, and 5 points for fourth place. And the two libraries that score the most points will advance to the next round. And they will face two libraries from another bracket, and we'll take it on from there. There also will be the possibility of consolation brackets where you can get matched up against another library that was eliminated so that your kids can keep playing in case your library was eliminated from the Smash Brothers bracket. To sign up for this, you do not need to have a GT System account to be able to participate in the National Gaming Day Super Smash Brothers tournament. And if you missed your chance to register via the ALA's registration form, you can email us directly at gtsystem@aadl.org and we will get you signed up and all set to go. The one catch about this is that this requires you to have a Wii that is connected to the internet that you have successfully played a Brawl match on the internet before. There's a lot of ports that need to be open on the technical side for the Wii to be able to work online and be able to have a match against another library. You've got to try it in advance. If you don't try it in advance of your event, you're almost guaranteed a rude surprise on game day. And if you have IT people or if you don't, you're going to need, either way, you're going to need someone's help in most cases unless you have a very open wireless situation. There's a page on the GT System Wiki called Getting a Wii Online that will give you some tips about getting your Wii connected and things like that. And of course, you can also contact us again at gtsystem@aadl.org and we can set up a test to try to get you online and make sure that we can have everything testing and working well before National Gaming Day rolls around. So that's Saturday, November 14th, National Smash Brothers Bracket. And we are trying to basically, it's up to you who you have participate in terms of age. Generally, we do Smash for grades 6 through 12 or grades 6 and up. But if you have younger kids there, go for it. You know, it's totally up to you. Even though Smash Brothers is a T-rated game, it is a very tame T-rated game, and very few parents ever have concerns about their kids playing Smash Brothers because, you know, hey, it's fun to see Mario and Pikachu hit each other. You know, what's not to like? The other event that we're going to have is something else that we're trying, and this is a national Mario Kart Wii tournament. One of the fun things about Mario Kart Wii is that you can have up 12 players in one match, so the tournament structure can be a little bit different. It's a similar sort of thing where you can sign up through the ALA's form, and if you miss that, just be sure to contact us again at gtsystem@aadl.org, and you can get registered there. I forgot to mention this, but both these events will start at 3 p.m. Eastern. That should be enough time that almost any library will be able to participate. Of course, if you're a Pacific library and you don't open till noon on Sunday, let us know if you're interested to participate, and we should be able to figure out something in some way to make that happen. But the general idea is if we start at 3 p.m. Eastern, there will be enough time for most libraries in the country to be able to participate throughout the regular time zone. So we'll see how that works out. So on Sunday at 3 p.m. Eastern, we'll be starting a Mario Kart All Ages tournament. And we've found that Smash is really great at teenage boys, but Mario Kart has a really broad appeal to parents, teens, adults, and everyone. And we're really trying to focus on the all ages component of this event. So you can register for that. We'll do a very similar sort of thing. We'll be matching up libraries and playing against each other over the network. If you can get signed up for it via ALA's thing, that's great. If not, you can, again, just contact us, and we will get you signed up, and you will get an email with full details. There's more information on the GT System Wiki at wiki.gtsystem.org. Got information about all this stuff. this is definitely cutting edge. You know, we're trying to push the envelope and trying to make interlibrary play happen. And it takes a lot of organization and things don't always go right. But when it does work, it's a really great and really fun thing for your players. So I hope to see you all competing and playing against each other and letting our players kick your butts in National Gaming Day coming up in November. And thanks so much for listening to the podcast over all these months. It's been a lot of fun to do them. And as always, if you ever have any questions about gaming or tournaments or libraries or any of that kind of stuff, please don't hesitate to contact me. It's just Eli@AADL.org. That's the way to get a hold of me, and I'm always happy to help. So thanks a lot. Good luck and have fun.
And that brings us to an end of another Games and Libraries podcast. This is a monthly podcast that we've been putting together with support from the Verizon Foundation and Thinkfinity.org, and we'd like to thank them for their continuing support of Games and Libraries. Until next month, hopefully you'll have some fun on National Gaming Day. What we want you to do is, if you have a good session, we'd like to hear from you. We'd like you to record a segment. Tell us what happens. No more than 10 minutes. Use any program to record an MP3 and talk about the effect that National Gaming Day had on your library. You can send those to me over at scott@scottnicholson.com. Thanks a lot, and I'll talk to everyone another month.
Ladies and gentlemen, let's put our hands together for the one, the only, Reverend Game.
Jorge, for that righteous introduction. It is my pleasure to be here today to talk to you about the phenomenon that is National Gaming in Your Library Day. I hope that perhaps you have some levels of enthusiasm for this experience, because the gaming is a wonderful way to reach out and touch someone that maybe you or your neighbor knows. With the flashy lights, the blinky blinks, the roll of the cup, and the noises of all the peoples around the board, young and not so young, a little older, somewhere in between, and the boomers too, all of you should enjoy the National Gaming in Your Library Day. It is a phenomenon unlike any known to people beforehand, and it's something you should participate in come this November of the 14th. It's a Saturday, which is the day before the Sunday, which is the day when you don't play the games, and it's the day after a Friday when you're like, woo, it's Friday, thank goodness, and you go to the disco with Donna Summers, and then there is the Leatherman. So it's a Saturday, and you're going to play games, and you can have some of the best fun with the largest tournament competitions and free games be sent to people if they're quick on the go. So take advantage, enjoy, and play ball.